Steve Poehler is a Buskamp Professor of Social Epistemology at the University of Warwick in the United Kingdom. Originally trained in history and philosophy of science, Poehler is best known for his foundational work in the field of social epistemology, which is the name of the quarterly journal that he founded in 1987, as well as the first of his more than 20 books. Rhetoric has always been central to his practice and scholarship, especially in terms of his advocacy of interdisciplinarity and the role of the public intellectual. His most recent work focuses on the visions for the future of humanity. Steve's title is the distinction between philosophy and rhetoric still worth trying today, and if so, how?
First of all, let me thank Bill for inviting me to this. In a way, I feel very much honored to actually address the issue about the relationship between rhetoric and philosophy, because in terms of disciplinary boundary negotiations, this is the oldest and most venerable of them all. And in fact, as you probably know, right, rhetoric was created as kind of a swear word by Plato for those other people who might be confused with philosophers. They were doing something different. And so the othering, the original othering, as it were, is how rhetoric came into being. And so there's a question as to whether this kind of distinction has a kind of positive spin to it, you might say, from the rhetorician standpoint, especially today. And the way I want to begin my comments is by talking about the sense in which the discipline of philosophy and rhetoric or communication find themselves in similar positions today. Okay, and that has a lot, and this is more of a kind of a sociological observation. And what I would say is that both fields are very much subject to instrumentalization. That is to say, the value that these fields have in terms of the knowledge they produce is primarily in terms of their service capacity, either to other disciplines or to the society at large. But there isn't a great deal of appreciation for the value of these disciplines in terms of the knowledge they themselves produce. Okay, and in the case of philosophy, I think I would point to two trends which I think have analogs in the communication field. The one that I think is a fairly obvious form of instrumentalization is, you know, if you look at the job market for philosophy, for example, in terms of where the jobs are, right, very often it's in applied ethics or applied something else, bioethics, biomedical ethics, things of this kind, right? Where in a sense you're basically taking some philosophical concepts into another arena, you know, and basically enhancing the education of other people who are regarded as doing the first order work. And that's pretty obvious. And within the field of philosophy itself, that kind of activity is, you might say, tolerated, but those who go down that route aren't usually very well esteemed as philosophers. On the other hand, equally instrumental, but a form of instrumentalization that actually is valued by philosophers, is when philosophers become conceptual underlaborers to the special sciences. Okay, so you become a philosopher of physics, a philosopher of biology, right? And this was something that in a way really only started to get ahead of steam in the 1980s when I was training as a graduate student, where I was advised as someone who came from a background in the humanities and social sciences that if I wanted to succeed, I should get an MA in some science. I didn't. I mean, and I thought it was a bit kind of bad that philosophers had to kind of somehow apologize for their existence. The only way they can sort of, as it were, show they were worth anything was by actually acquiring credentials in another field and then talking to that field, as if one's own field had wasn't sufficient. Okay? Now that's highly valued within the field, let me tell you. Okay? And I think in a sense, you know, the communication field in a way suffers from a similar kind of problem here. In a way, what's the way out of this? Now, you might say one way out of this is for communication to think about itself as a proper discipline with its own canonical body of knowledge that it reproduces for its own sake. I think that might have been a good answer when I was starting my career 25, 30 years ago, but I don't think disciplines have much of a future as the kind of, you might say, ontological basis, ontological substructure of the university as an entity. Right? Universities are actually being divided up in many more different things, because one of the things that's very key about a discipline in the kind of modern university sense of it is that you have people who are teachers and researchers, and there's some sense in which the research one's doing is feeding back into the teaching, and even, you know, and there is that kind of what, you know, Wilhelm von Humboldt is usually the point man on this for the modern university, the unification of teaching and research as being what the academic is about. Well, that's being split apart, and when that gets split apart, then the discipline doesn't really matter, okay? And so you're going to have, you know, on the one hand, you'll have people hired for teaching, right, and they will be hired for their ability to deal with client groups of various sorts. And then you'll have people doing research, but the research doesn't necessarily have to be tied to a discipline. In fact, it'll probably be pretty interdisciplinary by nature. Right, and you will bring a certain set of skills, methods, as has been, you know, mentioned earlier here. And that will be, as it were, your contribution to a large-scale research, probably externally funded to a certain extent, the, you know, the value of which will be, you know, maybe important, but won't necessarily reflect back on whatever field you came from. Okay, and so it seems to me this is the kind of world we're in now. And so to talk about the value of communication and rhetoric as a disciplinary matter, bounding disciplines and so forth, in the sense that, you know, which we maybe were, maybe it was reasonable to talk about it in the post-Cold War era, I don't think it's going to apply very much in the future. I think we have to kind of think about the problem a little bit differently. And here is where I think going back to Plato actually does become important, because in a sense we have to say, what was this dispute between philosophy and rhetoric really about at the end of the day? Okay. And the way I interpret this, and of course there's a lot of excellent scholarship in this field about this, and but I do think this is in a sense where we need to go back to, is what was Plato's beef with what he called rhetoric, okay? And I think there are several different issues here. One of them that I think is really quite important is that Plato, at the end of the day, did not really believe that you could, that in a sense, the kind of knowledge that we have about how the communication process works, to put it in more modern terms, was something that was fit for mass consumption, right? In other words, there had to be some kind of mediation, right? And in this respect, this is where metaphysics and philosophy and all this kind of high-minded talk comes in, that sort of recodes what in fact it takes to understand the nature of reality and to govern society and things of that kind. And what you really couldn't do was to actually bring this knowledge in a very, what might be called vulgarized way, to people so they could empower themselves. Okay? Because this is what the sophists were doing. Right, and the way you could see this at that time was the fact they were charging money, and if you were able to pay, they'd give you the knowledge. They didn't look at your character, they didn't look at other kinds of issues, they didn't look at whether you came from the right background or anything like that. If you could pay, they'd teach you the stuff. And so they made a point, as it were, whatever knowledge they had, to make it as widely available as possible if you could, as it were, keep the sophists living. Okay, so there was, and the sophists themselves, as was very clear from the Socratic dialogues, embodied what they taught. So in other words, their best sales pitch was themselves. Gorgias and Protagoras, and people would go around listening, watching them and so forth, be very impressed. And this is what gave Socrates the entree to question whether they knew what they were talking about, because they were in fact very impressive people. Okay, so what I want to say here, and I'm gonna wrap up here, is that there is a sense in which if you want to distinguish communication or rhetoric from philosophy, it's not necessarily going to be in terms of content issues, and it won't be in terms, I certainly in the future, not in terms of traditional institutional disciplinary boundary distinctions, but it will be, I think, in terms of whether you actually embody and transmit what you know. Because for Plato, there needs to be a kind of distinction, which we often call representationalism, right? What I know and how I represent it to you. Because you might not be prepared to accept it as it really is. And so I have to mediate it in some way, and that's where we get into philosophy and stuff like that. But for the sophists, right, they embodied what they knew, and other people then were attracted to them on the basis of that. And I think that idea of the self-exemplification of the knowledge that you have is really the primary selling point of communication as a field in the future, even in a world where we no longer have disciplines. And I'll stop here.